Welcome to episode 7 of the CSD at WCU podcast. Today we are featuring discussion related to pediatric feeding and swallowing disorders. My name is Elizabeth Grillo. I'm a professor in the Department of CSD at WCU, and I have three amazing panelists who will be joining me tonight for our discussion. So I will let each of them introduce themselves, and I want them to talk about the current stage of their career, their education and professional background, and how they became interested in the topic of pediatric feeding and swallowing. So let's start with Professor Sarah Moreau.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm currently the Director of Clinical Services at Westchester University's Department of Communicative Sciences and Disorders. It is a true joy to be back at Westchester since earning my bachelor's and my master's degree at Westchester University. As a professional, I'm certified in the SOS approach to feeding, and I've previously held the certification of lactation counseling for 6 years. When I think about my interest in pediatric feeding and swallowing, I can trace it back to a conversation that I had with one of my doctors, who specialized in hormone infertility treatment. At the time, I knew that I really loved swallowing, but I didn't know if I wanted to commit myself to working with the geriatric side of the lifespan. But whenever I was listening to this doctor, he was telling me that he started off his career in cancer research, and after doing that for several years, there was just an emotional drain on him, just seeing patient after patient pass away or not really get better in the way that he had expected to. So then he said he changed his career and he then started working with couples that had difficulty with infertility. So he completely changed his trajectory, moved to a different side of the lifespan, and that really gave me the inspiration to work with a pediatric population instead of a geriatric population. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I love it.
That's awesome. So now let's move to Hannah Breslin. Go ahead, Hannah.
My name's Hannah Breslin. I am currently a clinical fellow within the school district of Haverford Township. I graduated with my master's degree in speech language pathology from Westchester earlier this year. And I became interested in pediatric feeding and swallowing mostly during my graduate program. I knew going into grad school I wanted to focus on the medical side of the field, but I feel like I really found my niche within the pediatric feeding and swallowing community, especially during our interactive learning center simulations.
Awesome. We're so excited to have you on board with our discussion. So now turning to Nicole Diversa.
Hi, my name's Nicole Diversa. I'm currently a second-year graduate student at Westchester University, getting my master's in speech language pathology. I have a nutrition background, so that's kind of where my interest in pediatric feeding and swallowing started. I knew pretty much since I started college I wanted to work with the pediatric population in feeding in some capacity. And my history is long and complicated, but essentially I fell down the rabbit hole of working in a NICU and then having a niece who has complex medical needs who needed pediatric feeding and swallowing services. And all roads lead to us. And I just really kind of saw my niche in that area and I grabbed onto it and I have never looked back. So.
Awesome. I'm so thrilled. So just to tell people a little bit more about me, my background is in adult medical speech language pathology, specifically voice disorders, dysphagia. And I've been teaching the graduate dysphagia course at Westchester for too many years to mention. So I won't mention that. But through the years, I have really kind of taught myself aspects of pediatric feeding and swallowing. I am no way near an expert in this area. But I want to make sure that I provide, depth, well, as much as I can across the lifespan in my dysphagia course. I think generally the field in ASHA, speech language pathology, we tend to focus more on adults with dysphagia with less of an emphasis on pediatric feeding and swallowing disorders. So I am trying to get students interested in that area so that they can go on and become specialized in that in terms of pediatric feeding and swallowing. So let's begin with Sarah. So, Sarah, you mentioned that you have expertise in the SOS approach. So, please tell us about it. What is it, and how do you use it in your clinical practice?
So the SOS approach to feeding, SOS stands for sequential oral sensory. It is a transdisciplinary and systematic framework for feeding therapy that was created by Dr. Kay Toomey in the early 2000s. But you know, before we zoom in on just the SOS approach to feeding, I think it's valuable to offer context that Dr. Jerry Logeman's pioneering work in dysphagia, it occurred in the 1970s, which also had strong multidisciplinary ties, but then it led to ASHA officially putting the use of SLPs conducting the FEES studies as part of our official scope of practice only in 2001. So let's just pause and reflect that that's only about 30 years. It's pretty ridiculous whenever you think about that from the adult population. But then even more crazy is that just in 2021, there has been the diagnosis of a pediatric feeding disorder.
So only 3 years. That's only 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and we know that there's about a 17-year gap from research to implementation. So we're just thinking that, you know, we're on the cutting edge of what this means for treatment for some of these children. There's been different types of disciplines who have tried to work separately to help these kiddos. But really what I like about the SOS approach to feeding is that it takes all of the different disciplines and it kind of systematizes them and puts them together so that it is kind of in one package that a therapist can be trained in, which is really helpful.
And so Sarah, it's any therapist, it's speech language pathology, but it's so people who are trained in SOS can be from registered dietitian, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and those are all these multi-disciplines who are able to do this approach. It doesn't just have to be an SLP doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. The strongest presence is within registered dietitian, psychology and behavior technician or ABA. And then I don't know if I said occupational therapy. I don't think I did. And then speech. Okay. So those are the strongest presence, but it can absolutely be for a nurse or for parents can go to this training as well to help their children.
I just wanted to say one thing. Thank you for putting this in perspective. When I went to graduate school way back, dysphagia was not a required course.
Yeah.
I did not sit in a dysphagia class once a week. I learned on the job. So, you know, and that's, I mean, I'm not that old. So it's really amazing that you put that in perspective. So how does some, go ahead, Sarah.
So I was going to say, you know, we think about the SOS approach to therapy. It really is to help us just scratch the surface of, you know, what are the complexities for any individual with a pediatric feeding disorder? And having the transdisciplinary approach really helps us not just look at one area, but to be able to effectively assess and treat a child from all different parts of development. So instead of just looking at one part from a speech pathology lens, we really have the privilege and now information to look at them from a psychological perspective, from a developmental perspective, from gross motor and fine motor, to see is it just that we need to focus on chewing, or are there other things that we can support them in as well to help their chewing?
How does someone learn more about the SOS approach?
So somebody who most likely SOS is recommending that it's second year graduate students at the earliest under the supervision of somebody who has been SOS trained. And they can take the basic training course, which is a handful of days conference. And then after that, there can be a mentorship. And then following that, there can be certification, which is kind of more intensive mentorship, where you're giving videos of you doing therapy, and the SOS professors, they help you along. And for myself, going through all of those stages, that has been extremely instrumental in honing my craft.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, I'm an ESTL master trainer related to the ESTL voice training system. And I can reflect on, you know, a similar experience. I started in baby steps learning the approach, and I thought it was valuable to pursue the certification process because as I went through each step, you know, I've become a better instructor in the method as I go through. So it's valuable that, you know, this SOS has a similar framework. Can you provide one clinical example of how using the approach, the SOS approach, helped improve clinical outcomes for a child and a caregiver that you have worked with?
Yeah. Now, before I do that, here's my disclosure. The SOS approach to feeding is a specific framework to help families and children with pediatric feeding disorders make progress, improve their outcomes and their quality of life. However, as we know as clinicians, one size doesn't always fit all. But at least for the clients that I've had gravitate towards my practice, I can kind of make SOS fit the majority of my clients just because it is a flexible model. But it doesn't necessarily work for everybody. So before I continue, I wanted to say that. So here's an example of an 8-year-old boy who is profoundly autistic. He's minimally verbal, who came to me about a year or so ago. And after making minimal success with other approaches to feeding therapy, the mom was just really, really kind of devastated and looking for somebody who would see her son as a well-rounded child, and not just somebody who has a feeding disorder. And so he only had about 3 foods in his repertoire. And while he wasn't underweight, which is often a common issue, the mother had obvious concerns about him just not deciding to eat even his preferred foods. And so this is called food jagging, whenever somebody will have a preferred food and they eat it over and over and over again, and then they just burn out on the food. So he was doing that, but he only had 3 foods and he wasn't showing any signs of wanting to learn about new foods. So I will be honest that the SOS approach to feeding certainly is not a magic wand of progress. However, it did provide a framework to teach me how to really see this boy in all of his complexities. I taught him how to problem solve so that he could stay regulated and be with me at the table, and be engaged with me. And mom was right there too. So that's probably one of the biggest things that SOS did is it's systematic and it taught him how to be engaged, thinking about him being profoundly autistic. Engagement has to come first before learning does. So through this, we eventually expanded his food repertoire. And whenever I left my therapy job to come to the university, he was starting to put a variety of different pretzel sticks in his mouth. So thinking about pretzel rods versus pretzel sticks versus there's these things called dippers where like they're in the middle. And he was eating different types of cheeses. So like mozzarella sticks or American cheese or like grilled cheese. His progress was slow, but it was steady. And every step of his progress he made while he was calm and comfortable. And we know that whenever kids and adults, for that matter, are calm and comfortable, they're actually going to retain what they learn better. And so that's one of my favorite parts is that he was calm and comfortable. But then my other favorite part was seeing the hope in his mother's eyes when she saw him learning about food and then also being respected as an individual with sensory needs. And I have story after story of this where I see the hope in these parents' eyes light up, not because I'm able to offer a radical solution in 12 to 24 weeks, but it's because I'm able to teach them how to do what I do, but also there's hope for the long term.
Oh, that's such a great story. Wow. Can you? So his mom just, kind of a sigh of relief. And look, he was able to learn and develop a positive relationship with trying different food options, right? Oh, wow. What a positive outcome. That's wonderful. So let's move to Nicole. So, Nicole, I know that you recently completed the online SOS course. How long was it? And then, what do you learn? I know you're currently in my dysphagia class now, so I'm interested to hear how many days was it? What did you learn? How are you applying what you're using, in the class with me now?
So I think Sarah gave a really great overview of what it is. So it was 4 days long, and I actually did the Zoom option, just because there wasn't anything local to Philadelphia at the time, and I wanted to make sure I had it in my back pocket before I graduated. Let's see, it was 4 days long, 8.5 hours a day, sitting on Zoom with about 150 other professionals from all disciplines from all over the world. I think there was OT, dietitians, physical therapists, somebody that was from Norway. It was all encompassing. So Like I said, Sarah hit the nail right on the head about kind of what I learned. But I think the biggest thing that I learned from this conference is one, how to use the transdisciplinary approach in my practice. That's something I've kind of always geared and gravitated towards because I always think like I don't always know the answer. So I love kind of learning how I can use that in my future practice. And then how to, sorry, I lost my train of thought. Oral motor skills, that's the word I'm looking for. Learned a lot about oral motor skills. And the one thing I really appreciated about this course was I just always kind of thought feeding and swallowing were always under the same umbrella. And I didn't realize that there was technically a difference. I just kind of assumed they were one and the same. So I really loved learning the feeding aspect of that and how to treat the feeding component of the feeding and swallowing. And then utilize learning in your class all about the swallowing. I think I'm now able to kind of put it all together into one neat package. And it just makes everything make so much more sense.
So I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Can you define or describe feeding disorder versus a swallowing disorder for the
Oh God,
audience?
I
You could do
can try.
it. You just told us you know the difference. Put it in your words.
So a feeding disorder, I'm
And
thinking.
Sarah and Hannah can help, you
Yes,
know.
please.
We're having a discussion.
So I think thinking about a feeding disorder in terms of the SOS approach, it almost is, how do I want to say this? It's more than just chewing, right? Like it's not always necessarily, oh, somebody or a child cannot chew this food. Maybe that is the case. Maybe they have some, some tongue tip lateralization impairments where basically they can't move their tongue back and forth. Maybe they have weak jaw, they can't chew. But I also think, and what I learned from the SOS approach is maybe something else is going on. Like maybe something sensory, maybe something different. Whereas I think of a swallowing disorder as they're having trouble swallowing. There's some sort of impairment within their swallow mechanism that's happening. It's probably
Good.
not the most eloquent way to put it, but
I think it's a good start. I know Hannah wanted to add to it. Go
oh,
ahead, Hannah.
sorry, Hannah, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say, I feel like feeding disorders and therapy are much more holistic than looking at the swallowing portion. Whereas the feeding part, you're looking at the whole body, you're looking at the environment, you're looking at a lot of different factors. Whereas the swallowing, it's much more black and white. It's this is here or it's not. You can do this or you can't.
Yeah, Sarah, do you want to add to that? Go ahead, Sarah.
Sure can. So if we think about what a pediatric feeding disorder is, the definition of that is going to be impaired oral intake that's not age appropriate, that lasts 2 weeks or more, and at least one or more of the following areas. And the four areas are going to be medical. So that's where dysphagia and swallowing is going to be under. Nutritional, if they're underweight or a lack of nutrients. Feeding skills, which encompasses any sensory difficulties or they're having difficulty regulating themselves with food, and/or their oral motor skills. So oral motor skills is under feeding skills, and then psychosocial dysfunction. If there's a psychological issue, there's behavioral issues, maladaptive issues coming to the table. That's what defines a feeding disorder.
Yes, and that's 2021, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it now, oh, that's only 3 years old.
That's right. That's right.
Everybody. So, when we think about a swallowing, in terms of the adult mindset, geriatric tends to be more geriatric leaning. You're talking about the four stages of swallow. Where is the breakdown in the oral prep, oropharyngeal, esophageal? But you can see how the pediatric piece adds those two of the four dimensions. Is that correct, Sarah? At least two of the four, is that what you said?
You need at least one of them, but in the
Oh, at
geriatric
least one.
for we there's not really the nutritional component, and there's
Right.
not really the psychosocial component.
Yeah, right. Okay, so Nick, I just want to ask you one other question, Nicole.
Go for
So
it.
can you talk a little bit about how, so this on the SOS online course that you just completed in September, how is that impacting your experience in the graduate program, and how is that helping you to prepare for your affiliation that you'll be doing this summer?
Yeah, I think learning about feeding, and it, like I said, it kind of makes everything come together a little bit more for me. Like we were talking about, swallowing is just one piece of the puzzle, but actually learning what happens before the swallowing just makes everything make so much more sense. And I'm even pulling some stuff from my nutrition undergrad that I never in a million years thought I would ever use because that was too many years ago. But it completely just opened up everything. And I think learning everything into one mechanism, not one mechanism, but one process now is just so much more beneficial. And I understand swallowing, I think, a lot more because of it, because I understand what happens before. And I can kind of put it all together. And then in terms of summer, I have to definitely brush up on the SOS approach to work with Sarah this summer because it was a lot of information in 4 days. And even preparing for the podcast and just kind of going over, what I learned to talk about it, I was like, oh, wow, I learned a lot and it's a lot of information.
And part of the process, and I believe this is the SOS certification process, right, Sarah? People have to first participate in a course, like Nicole did, and then they move on and they practice with a mentor who's already certified in the approach, etc. You talked a little bit about that, but are there different levels of certification in the approach?
So there's either certified or bust. So
Oh, okay.
there's a basic training, and then after that, I think you're encouraged to take their advanced courses. SOS actually provides about 10 different advanced courses in different topics, and I've taken probably four or five of them. And that you get ASHA CEUs for them, but they're extremely helpful. And then after you take some advanced courses, then you can be up for the mentorship level one. And then after that, there's like the kind of mentorship level two, which is the actual certification process.
Where are you in the process?
I'm complete. I'm certified.
Oh, okay. And you think it was highly worth it to go? How long did it take you? Are we talking about years?
No. I think it's honestly how well you can use what you've learned from each step. So for me, I think it's taken maybe 4 years, but that's just like, well, I just finished one course. I have all this new information. I need to implement this before I think I'm ready for the next step. But I don't think there's anything necessarily holding people back. You have to pass one level before you get to the next, but so worth it. So worth it.
And are there many speech language pathologists who have gotten as high as you have, or is it unusual to have an SLP as advanced?
I think that SOS is growing. So part of the reason why it took me a while to become certified is I was on a wait list because they needed enough people to run the course. So there's not a lot of certified SOS speech pathologists, but I hope that'll change.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Okay, so let's turn to Hannah. So, Hannah, in your introduction, you talked to us a little bit about your medical affiliation experience this past summer. So, let's talk about your experience this summer. How were you selected for this, for the process, for the experience? What was the interview process like? Can you offer any advice for current graduate students who may be listening to this on how to prepare for that amazing Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania experience you had?
Sure. So, like you said, I had a wonderful experience at CHOP. It was truly a privilege to learn from their clinicians. So, I submitted an application and was selected for an interview. And this was conducted with the woman that would be my supervisor. And ultimately, after the interview, is when I was selected for the position. And during the interview, she reviewed my resume, application materials. She asked a lot of follow-up questions about my previous career and then some of the questions that I answered. She was fascinated by all of the simulation activities we did in our graduate program and just the technology we had access to, because this is something that not many universities have. And having the hands-on experience really puts you in a higher position going into an affiliation experience like that, because you're not starting from scratch. You have a foundation to continue learning on. And I
Yeah,
think.
and I would say an advantage to the supervisor would be, from a supervisor hat that I'm going to put on, ooh, maybe I don't have to spend as much time teaching this student foundational knowledge because the student's already coming to me with that. So it's almost like less work for the supervisor, and actually the work becomes with more depth, more advancement than you would typically do with a graduate student.
Yeah, by the end of the experience, it felt more collaborative rather than supervisory. I really felt like I built my confidence a lot. And granted, I had a phenomenal supervisor. She just had a real gift when it comes to teaching.
That's great.
And I think also having the MBSINP training prior to my affiliation filled in a lot of the gaps that many students come in with. So understanding the anatomy, what to look for on an MBS, how to approach clients at bedside, how to talk to families. I have the MBSINP, I have the simulation experience, and it really propelled me into the position. I felt very prepared.
And what, so you were working on the pediatric, where were you in CHOP? What type of floors were you on? What type of families and clients were you working with?
So I was the only acute care student intern. So I was lucky enough to experience a couple different units. My supervisor was primarily on trach vent and PICU, but then I also got to work on the oncology unit, NICU, general peds, and neurology. I don't know which would be my favorite because they all have so many cool aspects to them, but to get a little bit of each one was really awesome.
Wow. And so you worked with preemies all the way up to 18-year-olds? Is that your age range?
They do actually see people over the age of 18, depending on the disorder. So, if somebody has a unique disorder or diagnosis and there's a specialist at CHOP, they will not turn them away from their age, but primarily it's preemie to 18.
So you were working in acute care. How long were children on your caseload? What was the length of time typically?
A lot of that varied. So CHOP does geographic scheduling. So if I had a patient that was on, the trach vent unit and they were able to come off the vent and they noticed any kind of neuro impairment, they would get sent to the neuro floor and then they would be off my caseload, but still a current patient. So I had kids that I would see for a day and I had some that were there for the duration of my affiliation, which is not common in most acute care settings, but CHOP being CHOP, they do have kids that stay a little bit longer.
What was it like working with families with really medically complex children in that type of acute setting? What was the experience like for you?
It was a really eye-opening experience and a difficult adjustment because some kids you knew were going to recover and rehabilitate and move on, and others you knew it was more of a grieving process that, some of these skills would not be habilitated or some skills would never be able to be learned because of the nature of the disorder or diagnosis. And I think having that empathy continue to build throughout the affiliation really hones in on like how much we do as speech therapists because we have to treat the neck up, and that includes, that counseling piece and being someone that can educate, listen, and counsel.
Yeah, awesome. So reflecting on our what we talked about, pediatric feeding and swallowing disorders, were you thinking in that mindset? Was it because they're acute? Was the focus more on swallowing? Were you doing both? Can you talk about that?
Most of the focus was on swallowing because CHOP has a pediatric feeding clinic. And that's primarily outpatient based. So we knew that we had to get our kids up to a certain point, and then we were able to transition them to that pediatric feeding team. And it was a really seamless transition because a lot of the therapists there do both. They work in acute care and then they do 1 or 2 days a week in the clinic. And I think that's really beneficial because you're going in with a little bit of background on that kid and what they look like, how they present. So for us, it was mostly the swallowing treatment.
So what do you think students who are listening to this, who are interested in pursuing an affiliation at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, aka CHOP, what do you think they should do to prepare or early career professionals to be successful in the type of position you had this past summer?
I think it's important to review what you know about pediatric feeding and swallowing, and also just working with parents and caregivers. And then go into it and just trust yourself. You know, you got there for a reason. You have to believe in what you know. And I think it's also important to know your limits and understand that it's okay to say you don't know and that you're looking forward to learn from it because we're not expected to know everything.
Yeah. And so I think earlier you said that you are currently working in a school during your clinical fellowship period. So how do you apply what you learned at CHOP to what you're doing now in a very different environment, but you're still working with children?
Yeah, I think from working at CHOP, what I learned the most is seeing things from a broader lens and a broader perspective because when you look too closely, you tend to miss a lot. And I think there's a lot of similarities working in a school, whereas if you focus on what the disorder or diagnosis is on the IEP, you tend to miss, you know, what you can help that child learn or benefit from or experience. And even though it's school versus medical, it's two very opposite ends of the spectrum of what we do, there is that layover.
Sarah, Nicole, did anybody else want to ask anybody a question or make additional comments?
Sarah, can I ask you a question that I don't think I've ever asked you?
Ooh, sure.
I know, so tantalizing. How did you hear about the SOS approach and how did you get involved with it? I don't know if I've ever asked you this.
That's a really good question. Okay. So, I came out of graduate school and I thought I knew everything with feeding and swallowing. I thought I was really good at this.
Dr. Gorilla was your professor,
I
that's why.
know, professor. And I killed it. I nailed it in graduate school. So, going into the field, I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna do this. And actually, it halfway worked, where I was able to build for myself really a position where I said, hey, I'm gonna specialize in this. You're gonna want me. And so they said, yeah, I think you're convincing. Yeah, we want you. I said, great, we're both convinced. But whenever I got to it, about, I don't know, 60% of the cases I knew what I was doing with, but it was like another 40 where I'm like, I don't think I know what to do here. Why don't I know what to do here? I asked for all the expensive textbooks for Christmas. I read through them cover to cover. I really should know what's going on. And so that's whenever I was looking at it, I'm like, there's gotta be something else. Like, how could I not understand the basics of how to teach somebody how to chew? And what am I missing? And so yeah, by divine providence, I found the SOS approach and I'm like, I think this is what I need. I think this is what I need. I haven't heard of anything like this before. And so yeah, I signed up and my gosh. Everything changed from there.
Yeah,
That's awesome.
I have a similar experience related to voice. I mean, I don't know if Sarah knows the story, but before, so I thought similar to you that, oh, I knew what I was doing. I thought I was a good voice therapist, but then I said, you know what? Maybe there's something better. I've been talking to my friend Carrie Tellis about Estill. I've been reading about this. I know Kim Steinhauer. I'm like, let me learn what this is. So as soon as I took my first Estill voice training course, I was like, wow, look at all the stuff I've been missing before. And so now I think that I'm a better therapist. I think I'm a better instructor now of how to teach students how to help people with voice differences, problems, disorders. So point to new practicing clinicians. This may happen to you. You're going out and you're practicing for a period of time and you're realizing that, oh wow, maybe there's something else out there. So I'm going to investigate and see if there's other options. So always stay open to learning something new, right? Because it'll improve your clinical practice, clinical outcomes.
And I really like that, Liz, and I think that there's also a point where it's not just like one approach is absolutely 100% the best. I think that there can be approaches that are really, really helpful. And are they worth your time? Yeah. Are they worth your money? Yes, they are. But similar to staying open-minded, it doesn't have to be, one approach is the best over absolutely everything else. I think that there's benefit to a lot. And so just staying open-minded and being willing to learn from different people as new research comes, as new researchers come and figure out how do we synthesize this information to bring it to therapists, that takes time, real
Yeah.
time. And if we just kind of lock ourselves in this one textbook where there's one way to do things, then we're missing out. And more importantly, our patients are missing out. So, Feeding Matters is the nonprofit organization that is leading the research in feeding disorders. And they have had tremendous growth over, I don't know, the past 10 years and even more than that. And just seeing how they have different action steps and what they're doing for advocacy and just trying to learn and stay open-minded. It's very humbling for me that while, I think, yep, I can work with this population, I can make a living for myself. Well, there's going to be more coming down the pipe soon. And
Yeah.
to be ready for that and to be ready to be malleable and to change.
Right. Yeah. Flexible, adapt your practice to improve outcomes for our clients, caregivers, and families, because that's ultimately why we do what we do. So being open to those new ideas. Does Hannah, did you want to ask or say anything else? Ask a question or
I was just gonna say, we're learning every day. And I think just exposing yourself to as much knowledge and expertise as you can is so beneficial. Like, I've learned a lot talking to Sarah and Nicole today about the SOS approach that, you think you have a well-rounded idea of what something is, and then somebody says something and it puts it in a whole new perspective.
Yeah. So, to all of you, what additional advice can you offer professionals who are interested in this topic that we haven't already talked about? Whether it's early career professionals, students, people who are later in their career, do you have any additional advice for them?
So one thing I was thinking about during this when I was preparing is what advice would I give to my 18-year-old self? Fresh off to Penn State, has no idea what she wants to do. And I look back on my experience and I think of all the things that I said yes to, all the research opportunities, all the, school opportunities, the job opportunities, and I think, wow, I'm so happy I never left one stone unturned because I used so much of the information that I learned along the way that I just never thought I would use. So I think if I could give one piece of advice to anybody interested in this field, it's always say yes. Never close a door. You never know what you're going to learn, and you never know how it's going to impact your life in the future. And yeah, I think that's my biggest takeaway.
Awesome.
I think for me,
Go
it's
ahead, Hannah.
oh, thanks, Sarah. Always ask the questions, no matter how dumb you think they are. I'm sure Dr. Grillo can attest. My hand was always up in that classroom,
Yes,
always,
I
every moving team
appreciate.
on.
Listen, instructors are obsessed with questions. We want that. We want questions. We want discussion. It can't just be me talking the whole time. So I love that. Please ask questions. Go ahead, Anna.
Yeah, I think asking questions not only benefits you and your classmates, but it can open discussions that may not have been planned. And that's where a lot of carryover happens when you're really thinking outside the box and putting things into a conversation where you can connect to it.
Awesome.
I think I have two. I think my first one is specific to pediatric feeding, then my second one is more general. My first one, I mentioned in my introduction that I had held the certification for lactation counseling for 6 years. That was super beneficial for me in getting an understanding of how do I even begin to counsel somebody who might be in a stage of life that is different than mine, or even beyond that, might be in a stage of grief or suffering or missed expectations, than what I would even understand. And so that really helped build up my counseling chops. So the certified lactation counselor is through Healthy Children's Project. So I think it's just healthychildrensproject.org, and then you could get your CLC is what it's called. And just for the stage of or the season of life that I was in, I didn't renew my certification, but it was absolutely a really valuable tool for me, and I would recommend it to anybody thinking about how to help parents with breastfeeding, chestfeeding, and really how to walk with somebody. So that was really influential for me. The second one is to be dedicated to learning about other professions. So we think about multidisciplinary care and how do we work together with interdisciplinary goals. And I think for me, I've just loved learning about what my BCBA does. I've loved learning about what my occupational therapy does. And I feel like that has really enriched how I can view the larger development of a child. Had I not done that and been dedicated to that, I would be missing out on so much.
That's wonderful advice, all of you. And now I want to see if you have any advice for families and caregivers who are supporting someone with pediatric feeding or swallowing disorders. What advice do we have for our community to walk alongside them, to provide support for them as they work with their children who have pediatric and swallowing needs? Hannah.
Jump in. I think be open-minded. I think a lot of what we do, especially as SLPs, can be child-led, and sometimes it's hard to see the therapeutic benefit to it as somebody that's outside the field. But being open-minded and, again, asking questions and just immersing yourself in the process to support your child is going to help everybody along the way.
Awesome. Nicole, yeah.
To kind of piggyback off Hannah, I definitely think open-mindedness is a huge one, and encouraging them to be open-minded, but also encouraging them to ask the question, to seek out additional resources if something's not working. I think about my nieces and nephews. My one nephew is autistic, and my one niece, Paige, has cerebral palsy. And I just think about having discussions with my sister-in-laws and them being so stuck and so bogged down by their diagnosis sometimes about not knowing where to go. And I'm always encouraging them, ask the question. If you're unsure of something, try to seek out additional help. Chances are you're going to find somebody that can help you. It just might take a little bit of legwork. So keep the open mind and never be afraid to ask.
I think for me, one of my favorite parts of working with this population is I get to walk alongside the parents. And I think the most valuable lesson that I've learned from that is that I need to kind of be a detective of progress. I need to be a detective of growth and bright spots in that child's life. Because even as a therapist, you have your goals, and sometimes you're just not meeting them. And it can be very, very difficult and discouraging if it's session after session, and what you had expected for that child, they're not meeting. And even more, that's not my child. That child belongs to these two parents. And how discouraging is it for them if the therapist can't even find something bright and encouraging to say? Not that we have to have this toxic positivity, but I think that the most beneficial thing that we can teach parents is really how to reframe their thinking about what is success. What is success for that child? Is it that they're eating a wide variety of fruits and vegetables? Maybe in 25 years, but what does success look like right here, right now? Is it maybe that a child pushed away a food instead of eloping or leaving the table? Mm-hmm. Maybe that it's that they engaged for 10 seconds instead of 1 second. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a child is writing "Let's go" in the cheese instead of throwing the cheese off the table and like perseverating on the cheese. And Nicole watched this happen during one of my sessions. And it didn't seem like I had any control over the situation, but that's progress. That's progress. And so if I can highlight that for a parent, then slowly over time, the longer a parent is going to walk with me and walk with any therapist, then they're going to be able to see that child in a different light. And they're going to have just a more positive outlook, which is going to be better for everybody.
Yes, that is amazing advice. I appreciate that, Sarah. That's so realistic and functional. Thank you for providing that example. That was great. Does anybody have any final thoughts or comments to anything we talked about?
I have a question for you, Liz.
Oh, yes. Oh, boy.
What do you think is maybe one of the best things that you've learned about pediatric feeding disorders in the past 5 years?
Well, it has to be related to what you do, Sarah. So I have, you know, thanks to Sarah, she has opened my eyes related to the SOS approach She has come into my class, dysphagia class, for a number of years now to lead a discussion towards the end of the semester. And just even, knowing about it, the little bit I know of it, just knowing that it's there and what it does generally, has been a real positive growth for me. And like I said, my goal has been since I've been teaching this class that I want to make sure, to the best of my ability, that I cover as best as I can. It's a lot to cover. The age spectrum in a short period of time. And we're kind of touching on some of these subjects. And even with the adults, we are too, because I can't do everything. But we also cover craniofacial anomalies, kind of overview, and we talk about NICU feeding and some ideas for positioning and pacing and bottles and nipples, all the way to our geriatric population at the end of life. So it's a big area to cover, but I am just, my training was an adult medical therapist. I was not trained in pediatric feeding and swallowing at all. So it has been cool for me to see how I've grown across the age spectrum as I've taught this class. And as an instructor, I always try to be open to new things and figure out how can I bring this information to the students. Right, because the students are going to be the ones who are the new professionals out advancing the field, and you all are going to be the difference makers. So, if I can encourage you to be critical thinkers and think about how I can improve outcomes moving forward in my professional career, awesome, then I've done my job. And like I say in class, I'm not teaching you to be an average SLP. I know I've said this, you might have remembered me saying that. My goal is to not teach you to be the average person in the room. My goal is to teach you to be the most outstanding, think outside the box, way above average speech language pathologists, like the three of you in this room, because you're all making positive differences in the lives of your clients, families, caregivers, and other professionals you work with.
We will live up to it, I promise. No pressure.
Yeah, so this has really been fun. Again, I'm always love learning new things and learning about this topic. So we hope you enjoyed listening to our podcast. And thank you, everybody. Thank you, amazing panelists.
Thank you.